It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you're in the job market, it might pay off to work on your soft skills. Things like nice manners, punctuality, and getting along with people. We'll find out which soft skills employers value most and how to cultivate them.
First, Governor Scott Walker announced his proposed budget for 2017-2019 in an address yesterday. As part of his plan, Walker made this call for strengthening schools here in Wisconsin.
To help improve student success, we're investing more money into education than ever before in the history of Wisconsin.
In the budget, Walker calls for putting $11.5 billion into K-12 schools in the state, along with funding changes for the UW system.
Right now, we're joined by two education policy experts. Peter Goff is an assistant professor in the Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis Department at the UW-Madison. He specializes in K-12 education. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for being here.
And Nick Hillman is with us. He's an associate professor in the same department. He specializes in higher education policy. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Let's start off, Peter, with what's in the budget for K-12 schools. Again, here's Governor Walker.
We are putting $11.5 billion of state support into K-12 education. Specifically, this budget includes a more than half a billion dollar increase in per pupil aid for public education.
All right, a little disclaimer here. This is an initial budget proposal, can change in the legislature. Questions already being raised by key Republicans in the legislature. But taking this at face value, Peter, what does this increase do? Where does it stand in recent education history, given that there have been some cuts, some restoration? Where does it all stack up?
It does seem to be a bit of a reversal on Walker's part, given the $800 million cut he had issued initially, coming back and refinancing. It strikes me as more of a political move than an actual investment in schools.
Well, that said, though, I mean, it is more money in the schools this year if this goes through than in the previous budget. So is this something that is at least partially a difference maker for schools?
It will be a difference maker, absolutely. And you're right that it's infusing more money into the schools and they need it desperately. So in that regard, it will benefit schools. But one of the most problematic elements of the budget, in my opinion, is the flat tax, the flat grant, where each student is assigned the same amount of dollars regardless of their own personal situation or the district that they come from.
Right. This is a debate going on as part of the state's complicated school funding formula. It's, do we give the same amount of money, see if I'm getting this right, for each kid no matter where they are, or do we take into account extenuating circumstances? Kids in a high poverty district, maybe more money should go along with them, for example. That's the debate, as I hear it.
That is. And it's interesting that you use the word debate, because we use this exact funding system that Walker has proposed in my school finance class. It's a historic example. It started around the early 1900s. And it was quickly dismissed or modified because it's overly simplistic. It doesn't help promote the democratic ideals of education. And it's definitely a step backwards in terms of the funding structure.
And how does it work now? How would this additional money compared to the previous budget compare to the system as it exists now when it comes to money per kid versus money per kid asterisk, depending on their circumstance?
Sure. Well, the main circumstance that the current funding system takes into account is the property value of the district in which the child is going to school. So the current system allows districts that are property poor, that normally would have to tax themselves at a very, very high rate to get a comparable amount of funding, to use a pseudo benchmark set by the state, and then the state will basically backfill the rest of that money so that even poor districts can have comparable levels of funding.
We're looking at education funding proposals in the governor's budget released yesterday. Peter Goff with us, also Nick Hillman, both from the UW-Madison. We've been talking about K-12 so far. Nick, let's look at higher education big picture. Again, we've seen cuts, significant cuts from Governor Walker and previously from Governor Doyle before that. What does this new budget do?
This new budget includes, depending on how you want to count it, includes about $100 million for the University of Wisconsin system, and that's what I'll focus on, and that's what I've been paying most attention to so far. It would be $100 million for the UW system, which is an increase over what we've seen in recent years. The last time that we saw increases were a couple budgets ago, and so this is sort of a part of a long-term defunding of public higher education, but it's starting to go on the upswing.
And along with that, a cut in tuition proposed by the governor. And this is something that lawmakers have been saying, maybe that's not the way to go. But talk about the significance of the proposed tuition cut.
So that $100 million I just mentioned does not include $35 million, which would go for reducing the sticker price of college tuition by 5% across the whole entire system. And so that 5% reduction in tuition, it's not a freeze, but it's actually bringing tuition down by, on average, I think it's about $400 or so for a student. But it would bring that tuition down, and it would cost $35 million. No institution is going to see that $35 million. So that's why I separate it out from that $100 million.
That's just to offset the money they would lose in the tuition cut. Mm-hmm. You had posted a piece on long-term state funding trends for higher education in Wisconsin in inflation-adjusted dollars, I believe. Where do we stand now, looking back over the last couple few decades?
We stand at a low trough. The system was created in the University of Wisconsin system was created in the 1970s, early 1970s, and that was the period of time where we had actually about 30,000 fewer full-time equivalent students, but we also had about $500 million more dollars in the budget. And so you've seen over time, ever since the 70s, you saw a sort of a flat period in the 80s where funding per student stayed relatively flat. And then right around 2000, it's just been a drop year after year, it seems like, occasional upswings. But for the most part, we're far below where we ever have been historically.
And that line of state support keeps drifting downward, and the line of tuition was drifting upward along the same time.
Yes. So tuition became a larger budget item than state appropriations, I believe, in about 2010, the same period of time. And this is a national trend. It's not just in Wisconsin that this is happening, where states are divesting. They've got other priorities, other pressures, and they can pass that expense off to the student. And so you've got, across many states, students now covering a higher percentage of the tuition bill, of the cost of education, than the states.
And Peter?
It's a really nice analog to what we're seeing in K-12 education as well in this new budget. If this flat grant is used to the extent that I think it will be, as we see an increasing amount, what normally is picked up by the state as an equalization system, we're seeing passed on to the students. So students that the less affluent students, the students facing more challenges, it's left up to the state will give the same amount of money, and then it's left up to the individual to sort of make up that gap that they're born into.
Now, in his getting back to K-12 for a moment, in his call for changes in funding, Tony Evers, current Department of Public Instruction head, said, hey, we need more money for a couple things. Rural schools is one. Urban, he was hoping for. English language learners, special needs kids. Some of that, as I understand, is reflected in the governor's budget. What are you seeing there?
It is, absolutely. If we want to think about the pros of the budget, the fact that there's a reinvestment in public education, the K-12 system, that's great. We do see an increase in sparsity aid and transportation aid. That's definitely going to help the rural schools. There's a DPI request for a rural school teacher retention that was not included. But overall, this is a benefit to the school, but the question is it the best use of the funds?
The teacher retention was not included, because that's been an issue we've been hearing, rural schools, especially with particular skill areas, having a hard time not having their teachers poached away by schools that can pay more.
That's right. And it's interesting that Walker declined that element, as the poaching phenomenon is an artifact of Act 10, where we can start differentiating pay. We don't have that same contract system. And this would have been a way to infuse money into the system in a very targeted way that would have addressed, remediated a problem of the Act 10 policy that he put into place.
And Nick, speaking of targeting aid to where it might be needed more, we've heard from some Republican lawmakers, tuition cut, I mean, that's nice, but maybe we should leave tuition flat again and try to target financial aid to students in need, or maybe at the cusp of being able to afford higher education.
That would be an approach that would be well supported by research evidence, and that would be a very efficient and effective use of scarce state funding. And so we've seen time and again that need-based financial aid that is targeted towards students on the margin of maybe they're going to go to college, but price is just too much of a barrier. It bumps them over and encourages them to not just enroll, but also persist. And so that $35 million, rather than spreading that thinly across all the students in the system, could be targeted very narrowly towards that group of students who would be the most responsive to that subsidy, but that's not the direction that this budget proposes to go.
We're talking about how Wisconsin's education system, K through 12 and higher ed, will be funded in the state after Governor Walker's budget address yesterday. We have Peter Goff and Nicholas Hillman in the studio with us. They're both with the Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis Department at the UW-Madison.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the money being allocated to schools in the state? Do you think the budget goes far enough? If you're a teacher, what do you think of the budget? Or if you're a parent, what would you like to see improve in education in the state? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your questions and comments coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about education funding here in the state. Governor Walker announced that Wisconsin will increase spending for K through 12 schools and called for lower tuition in the UW system.
And we're speaking with two experts on education policy, Peter Goff and Nick Hillman. Both work in the Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis Department at UW-Madison.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the budget went far enough in providing funding for schools in the state, or were you happy with the levels where they were? If you're involved with the schools, if you are an administrator, teacher, a parent, graduate of schools, what do you think about what you're seeing in school funding? Call 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of an across-the-board tuition cut for UW system schools? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Nick wanted to ask you about technical colleges. The governor talked about them a lot in his State of the State as playing a big role in worker training for the economy of the future. What do we see there in the budget?
We see some similar things that we see in the UW system budget in terms of financial aid. There is a small amount of financial aid that's going to be targeted towards need-based grants, which just before the break, we talked about financial aid and how it's targeted. There is a small $10 million bump in the state need-based aid grant program, but that $35 million of keeping tuition down would be a different approach to funding that. And so the other part to this is you see in the tech college system this move towards performance-based funding, and they've had that in place for a couple of years now where state funding follows certain performance metrics, and that's retained in the Wisconsin Technical College System budget, and we're seeing it now also being introduced to the UW system budget as well.
And Peter, one interesting subplot in the school funding per pupil increase, schools get that amount per student if they comply fully with changes made in Act 10, which at least according to some reporting means the state's second largest city and school district, Madison, might be exempted from that increase.
Sure. It is an interesting twist. Act 10 gave districts the prerogative to shift the burden of insurance costs from the districts to the teachers, which it has its own set of you can have an entire conversation about that. But now Walker's saying that these districts, some of the districts chose to retain the insurance payment as a way to increase teacher retention, modify the climate so that they don't it's not hostile. And now Walker's saying that these districts that have made that choice in the past won't get this funding if they continue to do so.
To bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234, we've got Jimmy on the line in Waukesha. Jimmy, hi.
Hi. I'm glad we're talking about this today. One of the things I'd like to say first, I think Governor Walker said a lot of great things. I think the funding is unprecedented. What I'd like for us to do is to believe that that this is for the good of Wisconsin and that this can work. It disappoints me to hear the skepticism. The other thing I would like to mention that both Governor Walker has spoken about and our Secretary of Education DeVos has spoken about are for us parents that as much as we appreciate Wisconsin's education system and the wonderful teachers that we've got out there, some of us choose to homeschool our children. And I would really like to see an allotment, whether it's in the form of a grant or a tax rebate, for parents who choose to homeschool their children based on our values instead of the common core values of the federal government.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. So can you talk, Peter, about homeschooling and maybe other alternatives to public schools as represented in this new state budget? What do we see so far?
Sure. We do see a huge increase in the amount of dollars that are allocated towards parental choice programs in general. And Jimmy, one of the things, points that you brought up that I think is interesting is just the fact that we can educate our own children, and I think having that diversity is incredibly important. But one of the missions of a public education system is to support the democratic ideal, and that involves the intermixing of ideas and people. Systems that embrace choice exclusively. It's one thing to have a small amount of choice. It's another thing to have an extended amount of choice. It promotes segregation of both people and ideas. And there's also the idea it's difficult to think about systems that have done a good job integrating choice, but still having the oversight to say, as a state, what are the topics and ideas that we want all of our children to know, and then how do we have that discussion, especially with the homeschooling and the private schools, and then integrating that with the public schools.
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. We'll go next to Don on the line in Madison. Don, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Don?
So I have a concern. Basically, I want to know how Governor Walker would justify the fact that between this budget and the last budget, apparently, from if I have the facts right, $695 million budget shortfall, but yet then he is continuing to give and cut certain positions in the public sector, or not the public sector, but the governmental sector. He's going to give $700 million to a private school vouchers. Only $18 million or $19 million to the Milwaukee school system, which is one of the larger school systems in the state. And then currently, I work off of grant funding that comes from the Wisconsin DNR, and my position is going to end as of June of 2017. So, and I have a master's degree. So certainly some of the things that we think are important are definitely not on Governor Walker and the legislature that we have right now is a list of important.
Don, thanks for the call. We're going to be talking about changes to the DNR on the show actually tomorrow. Staying with the education side of things, Don, concerned about increases to voucher funding, charter school funding, as compared to what he sees in public school. How does that stack up, Peter?
I think that's a great point, Don. The one of the big threats that I see from the flat grant funding that Walker has put into place is not the money itself. As we mentioned, it's an infusion of funds where they're desperately needed. It's how they're being implemented and what Walker's track record has been in the past, specifically with charter schools, where they've started off as a very, very small segment. He got his foot in the door, and then they've opened drastically in the year since. And one of the things that worries me is that we'll see this trend continue in the privatization of schooling, but we'll also see this new flat grant trend increase over time. And my guess is it will come at the expense of equalization aid across the state.
Talking to Peter Goff and Nick Hillman from UW-Madison, looking at education, K-12 and higher education in Governor Walker's budget proposals. Nick, want to get to a point you mentioned earlier about the sort of performance-based system. Here's a listen to Governor Walker talking about how that might apply to UW.
That will include criteria like the number of graduates, the length of time to graduate, how many graduates are employed, and how many are in high-demand areas within the state. We want student success to help fuel the growth of the Wisconsin economy.
So, Nick, this performance-based system, you mentioned it's been in place, something like it, anyway, for technical colleges. What do we know about how this would work if passed at the UW system level?
Well, under the governor's proposal, there are basically six buckets that would be subject to different performance measures. The two biggest buckets that would account for probably about 60% of that share focus on college completions. So he mentioned in that clip college graduation and then post-college outcomes like meeting high-demand workforce needs. There are some opportunities and some challenges with this approach. I think primarily when you start to measure graduation rates, they become really slippery because you have a numerator and a denominator. And so a college could improve their graduation rates by simply reducing the denominator. And so they'll want to be a little bit careful with not designing a system that is easy to game that could actually work against some of the state goals. Because if you shrink the denominator, you have fewer students coming into the system, and that might actually restrict access from college.
Right, I hear that the role of UW-Milwaukee in particular is we're going to bring a lot of students in. Not all of them are going to thrive in the system. They may not graduate, but this is going to be a shot for people, especially in Milwaukee, who might not be expected to have college careers. This is their shot to go to a prestigious college. Is that a place that might be affected in particular?
It could be, and the devil's going to be in the details with the design. I think in particular they can learn some lessons from other states where that use input-adjusted performance metrics, and so you can account for the profile of students and the background of the students, the financial needs of the students as they come into the institution, and then adjust accordingly.
Just about out of time, I want to ask each of you in your own subject area. Nick, first of all, any points in this budget that you're looking at that you've seen so far or are watching for that maybe we haven't gotten to yet in our conversation?
There are a lot of non-financial items that I think will be relevant, especially for students right now, with regard to the segregated fees that they would now, if this goes through, would be allowed to opt out of or opt into, and that could have a lot of financial implications I haven't heard a lot about. The other would be the push for three-year bachelor's degrees, and it's not entirely clear that that would be an effective or high-quality way to deliver education. Again, the devil would be in the details on that.
And Peter, same question, but for K through 12 schools, anything we haven't gotten to that struck you about this budget or you're curious where it's going to go as it moves forward?
There's one element that I wanted to follow up on that was there's one part of the budget where Walker wanted to specify not necessarily the amount of the money, but how the money got into the schools, and it was to bypass the districts and go directly from the state into the schools. And I wanted, was curious to follow up to see, as Nick had mentioned, the devil's always in the details, sort of how that actually plays out, what the restrictions are, and what the motivation was for that to happen, especially coming from Walker, who's been such a strong proponent of local control.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Nick, thanks to you as well.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Peter Goff and Nick Hillman. They've been talking about Governor Walker's proposed education funding proposals in the state budget, K-12 and higher education. They're both professors in the Educational and Policy Analysis Department at the UW-Madison.
And coming up after the news, we talk with a Wall Street Journal reporter who says employers are struggling to find employees with soft skills like adaptability, grit, and in some cases, the ability to simply show up to work on time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we take a look at plans to adopt self-insurance for Wisconsin state and local government employees.
First, there are some job skills that just can't be automated or outsourced. They include qualities like empathy, critical thinking, and just simply getting along with others.
Yet employers across the country say they're struggling to find applicants who can demonstrate such skills. It seems things like empathy and good old common sense are in rather short supply.
Some employers go to great lengths to test for emotional intelligence, which in some situations may turn out to be more valuable than IQ. And we want to know what you think about soft skills and how important they are in your workplace. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Kate Davidson is with us now. She's a Wall Street Journal reporter covering the U.S. economy and Federal Reserve. Her piece on soft skills is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Kate, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, what skills are we talking about here?
Well, it's funny when I asked, I talked to economists and professors and academics and employers about what is a soft skill, what does it mean, and everyone kind of has a different answer. But you mentioned some of them in your intro. You know, the ability to get along with your coworkers, to take constructive criticism without lashing out at your boss, even just dressing professionally, showing up on time, speaking professionally. Communication is a really big one. It's kind of wishy-washy. It's like you know it when you see it. But all of these things employers say are extremely important and make a big difference in terms of, who is an employee that can just sort of get the job done, come in, punch in, and leave, and who really stands out and can excel in the job.
But why? Why are these skills in such short supply in today's job market?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's really difficult to answer, but I think, you know, a couple things are going on here. Number one, some of this reflects, to the scarcity, kind of reflects some really significant shifts in the economy that have been happening over many decades. You know, one of them is that, you know, you mentioned early on automation, you know, automation and outsourcing has happened, and so a lot of jobs that people used to be able to do where they would come in and they kind of just had one task and they were sort of doing it on their own. They didn't necessarily have to deal with other people. Now the responsibilities that people have at work have really become much broader. They're asked to do a lot more different kinds of tasks. For example, you might think of, you know, decades ago you would have a filing clerk and it might be a young woman. She would come in and she would just do that. Now she might be an administrative assistant who has to answer phones. She has to set up meetings. She has to make travel arrangements for the boss. She or he, of course, has to, you know, deal with a number of people in the office. It might be more of like an office manager type role. And so that just requires a lot more of these soft skills that we're talking about. And the other piece of that is that manufacturing jobs used to make up a much larger share of the labor force. And now we've shifted to more of a service economy where things like education, travel, you know, restaurants, bars, healthcare jobs have grown. So a lot of those kinds of industries, obviously, people are dealing much more with customers, and that also requires more of this sort of these softer skills that we're talking about.
We hear about automation and technology and outsourcing of jobs. One could argue that computers are able to do things like solve problems and organize information. So which human skills are computers and automation unable to mimic that well?
Well, it's kind of, I think the big one is that empathy, that empathy piece, and sort of the working across many different groups. For example, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I found this so interesting. I was talking to a factory owner who said, you know, it used to be that you could go out on my factory floor and we have, you know, sort of these high level, like white collar, if you will, engineers, and then you have the shop workers. And now if you go out on the floor, you can't tell the difference between those guys because, you know, the machines are now run by these very high-tech computers, and the guy that maybe used to kind of come in and, again, just do that one sort of basic job, he's now responsible for working this very sophisticated piece of equipment. If it breaks down, he has to be able to call the, you know, manufacturer in Europe and explain the problem to them and fix the solution. He has to deal with the engineers and maybe these high-level customers and explain to them, well, here's what we can do with our machinery. And it's again, kind of this much broader set of skills that you have to be able to use. And right, a computer, there's only so much the computer can do, clearly.
We're talking with Kate Davidson of the Wall Street Journal. She's written some pieces on soft skills and why they are so sought after in the workplace and perhaps a bit more hard to come by for employers who are doing the hiring. Kate, what is driving increased demand for these soft skills?
Well, the demand is coming from, you know, some of the factors that I mentioned, sort of this, there's just that more jobs require these skills. But I guess if we were to, I'm going to sort of answer a different question, or think about the supply issue, and you were asking earlier, mm-hmm. kind of why are these so elusive? There are, again, it's not easy to answer, but there are a number of different possible explanations. Of course, education is a big, you know, possibility here. Some people have suggested kids just kind of aren't learning some of these skills in school anymore. And so there are definitely, I talked to folks who run different kinds of training programs for young and old people. And I want to make clear, that was another suggestion as well. It's just millennials. They're just lazy. You know, they just don't have the same work ethic that the older generations had. And, you know, I'm sure that there's a little bit of something to that. But I talked to plenty of employers who said, no, I see this with older workers as well. So I think that, and it might be that some of those older workers, again, used to have a job where they weren't interacting with customers as much, or they were doing a narrower set of skills, and now, you know, after the recession, of course, also, they're maybe in a different position, or the industry they're in is downsizing. We're seeing that a lot, especially, again, in manufacturing, and so people are just having to adapt, and it's that adaptability piece that's really hard because it's expensive. You know, it's a lot of money to say, say, well, I might not have some of these skills, so I'm going to find this training program and I'm going to pay for it. And also employers don't pay for those programs as much. It used to be much more common that you would bring a worker on and you'd train them yourself, and that's not happening as much. So it's sort of this perfect storm. There's a lot of different factors that are contributing to this this problem.
You said millennials have gotten this bad rap we've read about for work ethic. But in overall, why do you think work ethic, this skill, is in decline?
I'm not really sure. So another kind of possibility that was floated, two things are coming to mind. Number one is the way that we communicate, and this does sort of go back to the millennials a little bit, is that so much communication is done over email and now texting, and it's sort of, younger people that are coming into the workforce, maybe the older generations are not as comfortable with that. Young people are comfortable communicating in that way, but their bosses sort of look at this and see it as unprofessional. And so there's sort of this culture clash a little bit, I think. And I've talked to some employers who recognize, look, that's not necessarily a bad way to communicate. We just kind of all need to get on the same page. Another interesting sort of theory is that younger people used to have high school jobs. They had part-time jobs. Now you have, an increase in extracurriculars, trying to pad up their resume, when you're getting ready to go to college. Kids are a lot more involved in that. Also, during the recession, a lot of the types of jobs, part-time jobs that would go to, say, high school or college students, they were harder to get because you had older workers who perhaps were laid off, and they were kind of taking those jobs that were sort of lower on the totem pole. And so the unemployment rate, if you go back and look at some of those rates for high schoolers or young people in their early 20s, the unemployment rate for them was very high, was a lot higher during those recession years. So, maybe they went to school, and maybe they even stayed in school, went to grad school because the work, the labor market was lousy. Now they're coming in, and they don't have any experience with workplace culture. And that's, I think we maybe take for granted, those of us who had summer jobs or jobs in high school and college take for granted that you really do learn a lot through that process. And maybe there's a lot of younger people coming into the labor force who just haven't done that.
We have a message here from Karen in Madison. She says, I certainly agree that soft skills help, but do you have any help for people on the autism spectrum who are diligent, loyal workers but are simply blind when it comes to these soft skills? Karen seems to be saying not everyone has the ability to have soft skills.
Yeah, no, I think that is a really important point. And do I have any advice? No, I wish I did, but I do think that those dynamics are, I think they're getting more attention. I can't tell you how many emails I got in the wake of my story from people who are saying, hey, we have a program to address this, and we're doing this. You should check out our school, or you should check out our program and see what we're doing. And I can't recall that any of them specifically related to people on the autism spectrum, but sure, I do think that's definitely an issue, and it's still sort of the old age first impressions matter. I think that's another thing that I learned in talking to employers, is they do make sort of quick judgments about employees. And certainly, right, if you just don't have some of those skills for whatever reason, you could be at a disadvantage. But it sounds like there is a movement toward helping people more with that. So hopefully that will, continue to change and improve in the coming years.
We're talking about the soft skills that employers say are increasingly important to productivity and yet hard to come by. Kate Davidson is with us from the Wall Street Journal.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are an employer, which skills do you value in your workers? How easy is it to find workers with these soft skills, being able to communicate with other people, work well with others, show up on time? And for everyone who has a coworker, have you found some colleagues just have the right something to make them great to work with? What do they possess? How have you developed your own soft skills? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at these soft skills in demand by employers in today's job market. Sure, you've got the technical skills, but do you have the people skills? Can you get along with the humans in your workplace, with your customers, your distributors? Call 800-642-1234 if you want to join the conversation. You can share your story. Are you an employer struggling to find workers with these soft skills like communication, critical thinking, common sense? As an employee, what have you done to develop these kind of skills and to use them in your workplace? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up the conversation with Wall Street Journal reporter Kate Davidson, who covers the U.S. economy and has written about soft skills. Kate, in your articles, you mentioned employers do some interesting things to assess soft skills. One employer actually took the prospective employee out to dinner with their spouse and family to see the interaction and how they interact with family members.
Yeah, I thought that one was particularly interesting. I think one of the big takeaways in writing this story is that employers, it's not just that employers kind of can't find as many job candidates with these skills, is that they're sort of perplexed about, you know, how do you know when you're interviewing, like how can you identify these traits in someone just by looking at a resume or just by having a having them in for an interview? And it's very difficult because some people interview well and then you get them in and kind of find that they don't work out, and I mean that's always been a problem for employers, I think, but it's now, I think they're realizing that if they need or they want to pay a lot more attention to it up front and try and figure that out so that they don't make a bad hire, because it's expensive, and it's expensive to replace someone, and training is expensive. So, for example, if you're going to bring someone on to a company and train them in some sort of very complex issue or a complex system or complex machinery, you don't want to bring them in and do all of that and then find out that they never show up to work on time, or that you can't come to them with criticism because you're worried that they're going to blow up at you or something like that. So they're investing a lot more up front in trying to kind of figure out the right sort of employee, and it's not easy.
Let's take a call now. Chris from Baraboo. Hi, Chris.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What would you like to add about soft skills?
Well, I guess I'm just echoing the comments that it seems like younger people, even ones that we have working where I work at, when they're initially brought on board, they don't ask any questions. If there's a probationary period, they'll call in sick prior to that. The impression is not there where it looks like you're confident they're going to show up for work tomorrow, I guess. And I'm not sure if it comes from school, if possibly school or parents can do more to set the example that you don't want to look like the weakest link of where you're employed or what you're doing, I guess. But I think that's how sometimes I get out of it.
Chris, can I ask you what industry this is in?
Actually, we're corrections.
Ah. Kate?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's so interesting, right? Just kind of knowing that, look, when you're on probation, you don't call in sick. It's just, right, it seems like such a basic thing. And, I think a lot of this, one thing that I didn't mention was that a lot of what's happening, another reason why this is kind of so important now, is that the labor market has gotten very tight. In other words, with the unemployment rate coming down so low, it's just harder there are fewer workers, first of all, who are looking for jobs. There are fewer unemployed people. And so employers kind of have a smaller candidate pool to choose from. They're competing more against each other for the best kind of workers. So a colleague of mine just kind of floated this suggestion that, look, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, if you had a job in a restaurant and you knew it was hard for you to get that job and there might not be another one waiting, you probably weren't going to make sure that you showed up on time and that you kept that job and you had bills to pay. I don't know if that's part of it, that now maybe there's more competition, that jobs are pretty plentiful, that people maybe are not as worried. I'll find something better if this doesn't work out, and I'd rather stay out late with my friends and, yeah, call in sick the next day or whatever it is. But I thought that was an interesting point, and maybe that kind of factors into it. it, but it's just another thing that's made it harder for employers to be picky and choosy. You know, during the recession, they kind of had a much bigger pool of people to choose from.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Raina in Oregon. Hi, Raina.
Hello. My question is, I'm hearing a lot of talk about millennials maybe not grasping a job or the soft skills that are needed for a certain job. I'm 24, and I wanted to know if there was anything in your work or your writing that you encountered that was related to like millennials in the workplace that, I don't know, just don't vibe with the types of skills that are needed for, you know, said job. Is that something common more, or, you know, like a workplace not fitting, I guess, the millennial mindset with these types of jobs?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's something to that. I talked to a professor in Pennsylvania, and at his university they run like a work center on the workplace, and they talk to students a lot about you know, how to prepare for the workplace, and training and professionalism is a huge piece of it. And he kind of had this nice sort of analogy, and he said it's like a workplace, you know, is every workplace, it's like every workplace has their own recipe. And you go in and you don't know the recipe. You kind of have to learn it. So, is it cool to come in jeans? You know, you're gonna have to figure that out. But right, don't go to work on the first day in jeans. This is a little narrower, I realize, than kind of what you're asking about. But I think that his overall point was that, right, some workplace cultures, there's a huge spectrum now. It's not like it was 30 or 40 or 50 years ago when you were in an office, a professional office, they all of them kind of had the same standard for dress and for professionalism. There's a broad range now. So yeah, I think maybe there are a certain group of people that younger people especially expect, for example, more flexibility perhaps at work. Or like I was saying earlier, you know, they don't think it's a big deal if they're on their phone texting, because maybe they're answering an email actually from a client, or maybe they're texting a client or doing something work related. But I talked to some folks who said that there are older people in their office who would see that and think the person is kind of just wasting time. So there can be kind of this culture clash. I don't know if I could identify, say, an industry where it's just not good for millennials. I think it just really depends. But I think that it's hard for younger people certainly to figure these things out. And I talked to some employers too who said, look, we realize our customers are getting younger, so we need to adapt too. We're not always expecting younger workers to come in and just do things the way we do them. We want to learn from them as well, and we want to serve our younger customers, and things are changing. But all of this is just, I think it's slow. It's slow moving. It's a slow process.
Raina, thanks so much for your call. Kate, if you realize you don't have these soft skills, or you feel lacking in some area and you realize that you're lacking, are there ways that you can cultivate these qualities, perhaps even on the job?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that having open communication with your superiors is clearly really important. I talked to some bosses who said that they have started instituting more regular reviews. You know, you kind of think of the traditional annual employee review once a year. You sit down. Some bigger corporations said, "Oh, we do them like at least quarterly, and sometimes have managers sit down just once a month to talk about, you know, say, career goals or areas to work on, room for improvement, things like that." So obviously, if you can be one of the qualities employers want is to see that people are proactive and taking the initiative. I think that if you're going to your boss and asking, how can I improve on these things or work on them, that's obviously going to help. This is a little bit funny, but I talked to one big staffing firm that said he's seeing a lot of companies encouraging their younger employees especially, but even people who are sort of in line to become managers or move up the chain, they're encouraging them to do Toastmasters, learning how to get out and speak in front of a room full of people and improve your speaking skills. That's another way that you can do this. I talked to a group that does training for basically IT. It's kind of an IT-type training program. People that are transitioning from other industries and want to move into the IT field, and they do these exercises, a six-week program, and one of the things they do to build soft skills is they read Humans of New York. Are you guys familiar with this?
Like, I'm going to have to stop you there. Kate, thank you so much for joining us. That was Kate Davidson, Wall Street Journal reporter covering the U.S. economy and the Federal Reserve. Her article on soft skills is on our Central Time Facebook page.
Moss Eisley Spaceport. You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
Wise advice there from Obi-Wan Kenobi, but when do we get to use it? We can't go to Mos Eisley Spaceport, or can we?
Never say never, Rob. The Disney Corporation, which now owns the extremely lucrative Star Wars license, announced this week that it's building Star Wars-themed lands at Disneyland in California and Disney World in Florida.
One highlight, apparently you can pilot the Millennium Falcon and walk in the shoes of Han Solo. So you can reenact a lot of your favorite moments from Star Wars. You're a fan.
I am. I just want to hug Chewie all the time.
Hug Chewbacca display. I don't know. We don't know the details there.
I just want to, in person, hug Chewbacca. And I would be good. That would be it.
That would be
just
the whole thing.
Fuzzy. Yeah.
I don't know if that's worth the price of admission all by itself.
I know.
And then, like, is there the, you know, jump into the garbage chute option? I could probably pass on that, too.
Right, right. But, you know, it's pretty cool. And, you know, I'll just wait and see. I'll wait and see till this thing opens, and then we'll decide.
And maybe a quick drink at the cantina. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.